Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and build a good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western and I will be talking to invited guests about different themes, exploring social, conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. So a very warm welcome to episode one of Edgy Ideas. The theme we are addressing in series one is pandemic psychodynamics, international perspectives. We invite experts, coaches, leaders, and academics from around the world to share their thoughts and experiences, exploring the conscious and unconscious dynamics that are playing out in specific regions. We will conclude this podcast by asking how we can live the good life at a time of trauma and how we can create a good society as we exit this pandemic. I'm absolutely delighted to introduce my first guest. His name is Zachary Green, a friend and colleague I met many years ago at a group relations conference. Zachary is a professor of practice in leadership studies at the University of San Diego, United States of America. He's a co-founder of Group Relations International, and he has over three decades of experience coaching and consulting to the unconscious and systemic dynamics of global organizations such as the World Bank. So Zachary, very welcome. Very good to meet you.
Well, thank you very much, Simon. I'm very glad to be here with you.
So pandemic psychodynamics, you're living in the US of A, you're in San Diego. What's your first associations when you think about the psychodynamics of what's happening, Zachary?
In the United States, we have an interesting situation. I think it reflects the polarization of the country. On one hand, we have those who really see this as an opportunity to re-examine our values and the way that we live our lives, to recognize our relationship to the planet in terms of the living systems on the planet and our fellow humans on this planet. And then we have almost as powerfully a force where there are, let's say, a xenophobic, reductionistic, and projective process going on, where the wish to blame others, create boundaries, and to really figure out how others can be denigrated for this circumstance, dominate the discourse. And this is a sort of a classic splitting that our country is living. And it's difficult to witness it and to also recognize that by living here, I'm participating in it.
Yeah, so that splitting, it's like an amplification of what was already there. Is that right? That you had these kind of culture wars going on and these splits, the Trump and the other, and it's amplification of that experience. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's unfortunate that we see those kinds of elements present. Very recently, we've had two strong expressions of it. One, there are protests that are going on in some places around the stay-at-home orders, but it's not just protests, but these are armed protests, where the right to bear arms is being practiced and people are standing on the steps of state capitals saying that this is something that violates the liberty of people. And then the president himself put forward an executive order banning immigration, which therefore really puts the focus on those external forces, sort of like naming the coronavirus the Chinese virus as a way of extending this outward to look for where is that projective object. And that is really something that really seeks to demonize, and it continues to be very present in the process right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, isn't it? The COVID-19 health scare and fear is everywhere. And but you're saying in the US that really there's a secondary kind of equally fearful kind of scenario being played out through this splitting.
We have that as one part of it. And then we also have the other cultural war element of this, because the data are now coming out in terms of who are the more vulnerable populations. And so even though the death rate, sadly, is still among European or white Americans in the United States, the rate of infection and the disproportionality in terms of communities of color, and what we mean by that in the United States context is people who are African American or Black, and people who are Latino or who come from countries such as Mexico and Costa Rica and the like. And this speaks to the difficulties that we've had around healthcare for years in this country. And it also points to the challenges around access to that same care. And it therefore exposes how these inequities are enacted, and the projective process is not simply a psychological one, but it has these physiological or medical or health consequences. And the discourse around that is becoming really challenging, because with the blaming and projection on one hand, and the real experience of this, then there's this dance, especially among some right-wing bloggers, of the sort of the victim mentality and a naming of victims. It also creates a circumstance where, in addition to Asian Americans having a disproportionate number of hate crimes perpetrated towards them, you also have Black people becoming phobic objects related to the virus, and so therefore are seen as more likely to be carriers of the pathogen. And all of these things are playing out to create, a very complex circumstance right now.
It sounds very complex. It's interesting to pick up on what you're saying about how this virus is kind of revealing what's been repressed, which is these undercurrents of disadvantage, undercurrents of oppression, undercurrents of racism. And it, again, really amplifying kind of what's there, partially hidden, and now it's like really in your face.
Yes, it is in our face. The sort of gallows humor around that is that the irony is that we already knew this, but then to see this played out in this crisis is what is so challenging for many of us who are looking at how these trends are going.
Yeah. And what's happening through the lockdown? I mean, what are you picking up through kind of this scenario of the lockdown? You've mentioned that there's some right-wing kind of libertarians who are using it to protest against it. But how are people kind of living in that space? What's your experience of that?
Well, that's another unique part of the character of the United States. We have this balance between states' rights and federal authority. And so in terms of authority, you have this debate going on between the federal, which would be Trump and his administration and his experts when he chooses to use them, and each state and their autonomy in terms of their own policies. And within each state, then you have each locality having its own set of different processes that they're using. The dynamic tension in terms of where is the boundary of authority in each of these situations is something that is playing out over and over again. The most prominent picture of this is the difference between the response of the president and the response of the governor of New York. President Trump sometimes attends to, but often undermines, his own authorities, who are the scientists and medical experts on the nature of this virus, in his daily briefings. In contrast, we have the governor, Governor Cuomo of New York, and also the governor here out in California, Gavin Newsom, who are attending strongly to the advice of the medical experts, are making decisions that really are seeking to flatten the curve and are operating in ways that they are constantly communicating a consistent message. So the ways that the authority is manifesting itself in these different ways is something that is creating both an opportunity and a confusion. And based on where people are, ironically, on the political spectrum, they tend to attend to the authority that is most aligned with their political ideology. And so what we have here in California is that on a relative population basis, the curve is less intense than other places in the country with smaller populations. And as a consequence of that, it plays out very differently. The degree to which a lockdown is enforced, the degree to which people collectively attend to the stay-at-home orders and things of that sort. So if you look at our state statistics, people are using it blithely, but ironically again, and kind of in a sardonic way, as a competition between the states in terms of their per capita death rates and infection rates. And so it's a really shadowy part of this whole process.
Yeah, that is dark.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess in Europe, there's a bit of that playing out between countries competing as to who can win the league of best outcomes or worst outcomes. Yeah, it is quite shadowy. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And thinking, someone said to me from the US, a colleague, that they said, we got a triple whammy here. We've got healthcare, wealthcare, and Trump. And I thought it was quite a neat way of putting it that, you know, that the real fear and welfare and healthcare, of course, are linked. You know, if you've got a job, you might have health cover if you're lucky, if you have a certain type of job. But with the economic deficit, there must be a huge kind of this kind of economic fear of kind of what you lose through this kind of pandemic.
Well, there are two pieces of this in terms of healthcare. Yes, we already knew that this was a problem, and the number of people who are uninsured and therefore do not have direct access to healthcare is a very real issue here. But there's also what I would call wealth care. You know, what I mean by that is that we have this stimulus package of several billion dollars that was put forward that assures that some parts of the economy will be able to recover from this. But what we also have underneath that are the unemployment figures, which again disproportionately hit communities of color in our country, but also those are people who are already marginally employed, living paycheck to paycheck. And in some places in this country, there are relief programs that allow people to defer their rent payments and things of that sort for the duration of this pandemic. But in other places, people are being evicted from their homes, and there is no protection. And so where the focus on protection is at the larger macroeconomic capitalist level of this process. And those who are the most vulnerable are sometimes left out of it. And another deep part of this is that those people who have been at the forefront of some of the projections in terms of our immigration argument are now seen as essential workers, which means that they are really needed to work in the grocery stores. Pick the crops as they come to harvest time here. But yet at the end of this, we know what's going to happen in terms of the rhetoric. And so this is the sort of cyclical nature of this kind of process that we're in right now.
Yeah. And in... You're a student of leadership. You've been a student of leadership and authority through your study of group relations and in the workplace. How do you see leadership playing out in the workplace? You've got some big famous names there. You have your Googles and your Facebooks and your Apples. You have these kind of very famous kind of leaders from the US economy. Do you see what do you see from leadership from the work perspective?
Well, what is fascinating about how this is playing out, at least from my perspective, is that you do have people who recognize the economic impact of this, and you also have voices that are attending to this in very compassionate ways in terms of at least presenting the voice of the need to take care of employees, to provide ways that people, if they do become ill with this virus, do not have to dip into their sick leave and things of that sort. So you're seeing those things. The larger leadership piece of this is that there are voices collectively that recognize that some things about our economic interconnectivity is being played out here. And then in that process, then what we're determining is then how do we recognize that there are both opportunities that can be afforded here, but there are also limitations that are being presented in such a way that we can no longer ignore them in terms of the equity, in terms of economics. From a leadership perspective, also what we are beginning to recognize that certain followers are recognizing that absent their own autonomy and capacity to have voice, that they have a very delimited impact on what this is. So the death of unionization in this country, for example, is something that means that there are fewer people who have an opportunity to have a collective expression of who they are. And therefore, the dominance of the economic representation then begins to be the voice, sets the boundary, creates the authority dynamic that we see playing out over and over again. That's the first part of this. The second part of it is that the shift to the gig economy here, you know, the Uber drivers and the like, then that was an element that was sort of providing a safety net. All of that got wiped out in the last month.
Yeah.
And so the impact that has in terms of the shift, in terms of me feeling as if I have some authority, autonomy, capacity to create my own situation and circumstance to improve my life financially and therefore economically for my family, then the vulnerability of that sector has now also been presented. So all of these things are playing out in terms of a leadership relational authority dynamic. It's not simply the leadership element of this, but also the followership and the relational orientation of this whole dynamic.
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying is very interesting because you're talking about projections and splitting initially. And now, as you know, I'm a student of Lacanian psychoanalysis.
Yes.
Apart from other things, and it seems to me that this is exposing so many gaps and so much lack that kind of like we knew it, but it kind of like people knew it at one level, and this is kind of really an amplification of these gaps. And in psychoanalysis, there's a thinking that lack creates desire. So I'm wondering that there's going to be a big force and a big push from some elements of the US society, a big desire from this lack. There's going to be a big desire for change. Do you feel some of that?
I want to believe that that's going to be dominant. I want to believe that the exposure of the lack, especially the lack in terms of our interconnectivity and capacity to see our common humanity, that's what I want to believe.
Yeah.
And there are a number of people who are beginning to express themselves primarily in that kind of way. Similarly, one of the stronger pieces that's been written on this is about the gaslighting, or that's a play on a famous film, where There is going to be this presentation of everything is okay, everything is normal, nothing really happened. Let's go back to where we did things before. And the lack economically, in terms of how our capitalist orientation plays out, will be a push towards a normalcy that was recognized prior to the pandemic. The other lack is that of touch, contact, compassion, care, and indeed care for our common home, this planet, that is also playing out. And what is going to be absolutely fascinating from a leadership perspective is then how the tension between the wish for what I would call a regressive return to previous orientation in terms of how we function is going to be right next to what I think is also a shift in consciousness that is available. And your own writing in terms of eco-leadership speaks to this, is that there is a leadership spirit. There is an interconnectivity and the desire for that connectedness is very real, very palpable, and also equally denied at the same
time. Yeah. I mean, my writing and my work is so interesting for me because it feels like this COVID-19 is again, an amplification, a kind of a shock to the system, but not an unexpected shock in the sense that we've been writing about this kind of triple ecosystem impact, the kind of impact of the digital age, kind of how that's made us all more interdependent, interconnected, the environmental crisis, how we can't escape kind of a local and global kind of climate change and hyper-globalization, you know, what does that do to us? And COVID-19, the essay I wrote on it, I really kind of thought that this is not a surprise in some ways. This is kind of more of the same. This is more of what we've been talking about, but like in one big dose. It's almost like you're jumping into climate change kind of 10 years ahead and here it is. This is kind of the kind of thing that we're facing. And it requires the same solutions we've been talking about for the last decade. So we have some preparation. We have some materials. We do need eco-leadership. We do need to kind of think about ecosystems. You can't separate nature from humans, from technology. Kind of the three things together create the world we live in. And we have to kind of come to terms with that and find ways to kind of deal with that and to deal with it in a way which kind of brings our spirit and our faith to the game. Because, you know, another thing I want to ask you is kind of, I don't know how you describe yourself, but I think of you as a person of faith.
Yes.
And kind of how faith plays out for you in at this moment and for the community you engage with.
I'm happy to speak to that because just as you pointed out how the whole eco-leadership piece of this is really alive and well, and the pandemic is really expressing it, I think there's also something about the inner journey that is also happening. And from a spiritual perspective, I think faith communities in general are recognizing that our ancient practices provide us the potential for some solace in this moment, that the faith allows us to recognize that there are things that are greater than ourselves that present themselves to us from time to time. And that this is not simply a virus. This is really a wake-up call, an opportunity to consider our relationship to the divine differently and to attend to our relationship to the universe. But the universe specifically in terms of this planet, in terms of my own meditative practice and reflective practices, what I am discovering is there are places anew that I would not have ventured. Often places I don't want to go, to be quite honest.
Sure.
But then in the excavation, in those explorations, what I am finding in my more private conversations with people who are of a like mind in this kind of spiritual realm. What we're all beginning to see to some degree or another is that there is also a very deep invitation to a question of calling and purpose, of consciousness and compassion, and to recognize those deep gaps in how we have been a loving presence to the other, and that the other is not an other, but that other is the other within ourselves. And then going back to this splitting projective process, that we project those aspects outside of ourselves. And then what would it mean to reincorporate those, to really recognize that those are, they're parts of ourselves and that they are present in others. And then how do we hold that in ourselves and in others?
Yeah, yeah, that's the work. That is the what we call the work.
Yes.
I just had a flashback, an association that I did a PhD at Lancaster University, which was the research for my leadership critical textbook. And I wrote about the first three discourses, the controller, the therapist, and the messiah discourse. And then I went to the USA to study. I went to study theology at Berkeley University. And I was a dropout. I lasted 3 months. And it wasn't the course for me. I loved it, but it kind of wasn't, I wasn't going to spend 3 years there. I just knew it wasn't right. But I traveled from there to a monastery, to a hermitage, interestingly enough, in California, along the Big Sur.
Yes.
And it was a hugely moving experience to me. And I sat at this hermitage in isolation, which is kind of strange because now we're talking about being in lockdown. And I was with these monks, and it had a massive effect on me. And I wrote while I was there, and I wrote the final chapter of my book. And that was the first emergence of the eco-leadership discourse. I was sat with monks in isolation in a place of deep faith in the most beautiful part of nature I've ever been, I think. It was just wonderful. I sat on top of a mountain overlooking the Pacific. And that's where I got inspired to write about eco-leadership. And it is so interesting that parallel of being in a kind of a hermitage, being in lockdown, and being in a quiet place where one can think and one can get in touch with that deeper inner self, is where there's a source of new life, new energy, new thinking, and something we all need to tap into.
That's very true. That's the wonderful thing that you write about, and you also know that Otto Scharmer writes about the same kind of thing, where if we tap into that source, then we come closer to a deeper presence. And I believe that if some of us shift the language from lockdown, even though it's used, and it's kind of interesting that we use this prison metaphor, and that we don't talk about hermitage, we don't talk about solitude, we don't talk about reflective space. And what would happen if we began to shift our language around that, so that the narrative that we're creating unconsciously is different? And then from a more of an archetypal perspective, then what would happen if we're engaging more of like a monk mentality in terms of embracing that, or the wizard or that goes to the edge of the village alone, so that the deeper wisdom or a different way of knowing can begin to emerge?
Yeah, I think that's so interesting, because I've actually been doing that for myself, thinking about kind of the monastic life and the monk within. When I was in the monastery, they talked about the monk within and developing the monk within. And I think we all have a monk within. And it's about finding that space and changing these metaphors from lockdown and kind of we're in a war to we're in a different place, and to find these kind of deep inner spaces and to connect with others in new ways. I guess, Zachary, we're drifting into the territory of how to live a good life and how to create a good society. I think we spent a bit of time thinking about the good life, which is changing these metaphors and thinking about kind of using this space in a different way. Do you have any thoughts about coming out of the pandemic as we kind of move out of it in the next kind of 12 months or so? How we can use this experience to create a good society or move towards creating a good society, whatever that might mean for you?
I really appreciate you asking this question, because the paper I wrote on mapping the contagions, developmental response, is exactly that, is that we don't know how we're going to get out of this, but there is the potential of an emergence, and that emergence comes with the capacity to enjoin, I do really want to use that word, our resilience, our ability to recognize that there is a collective level of a trauma, because this is an experience that's disproportionate to any of most of our lived experiences, people who lived through World War II, but I'm talking about at a global level.
Yeah.
That there's the collective element. And so the first part of living into the next phase of what the world is to become is to figure out ways that we can each embrace our own resilience and also help build the capacity for resilience in other people.
Yeah.
To help us each discover those practices and capacities that are already within us, but may have lay dormant because we were so in this frenetic, quasi-manic way of being, many of us, at least in Western context, no pun intended. And to really work with those aspects of it. So that's one aspect of it. The second part of it is that there is research that's already beginning to show, there's a wonderful Harvard Business Review about building resilient teams that came out. And what they speak to is that asking ourselves the question, and what I mean by asking ourselves the question, is to get into the deeper why of us, each individually, and then to not only deal with the why of us, but also to deal with the capacity for compassion for that which is us, but is expressed in another person with greater understanding and a true wish to find those places and spaces of interconnection, of intersectionality.
Yeah.
And to build those bridges of connectedness that you've written about with each other.
Yeah, that's a very rich note to end on. Zachary, it's been an absolute delight talking to you. I love the mashup of psychoanalysis, faith, critical theory, leadership, group relations. It all comes together. Beauty.
It does. It does. And I really appreciate the quality of that journey with you. It really speaks to the range of ways that we can speak to this complexity, but find our way. And that's what this is about, finding our way.
That's good. You go well. Love to the family. Take care.
Okay, thanks. Okay, bye now.
Bye now. Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like more information about our work, go to www.analyticnetwork.com or contact Simon at analyticnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.